From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Not so long ago, Tim Sullivan decided to take a road trip around the West. No big deal, right? It's been done. But here's the twist. Sullivan wondered if he could pull it off without using a car or using one as little as possible. He'd done road trips like this before in foreign countries where he'd ridden a bike and taken trains and cabs. But the West, that's another thing altogether, because this place was built on the idea of open space and freedom. And if you're getting around, it usually means you need your vehicle. But Sullivan says that's changing, that the car's hold on this country seems to be loosening. So he headed out to find out what the West would feel like without the speed or convenience of a car. He'll join us today to talk about what he learned, and we're hoping you'll join us as well. Can you do it? Get around the West without a car? After the news. This week on Video West, you can go mushroom hunting with the great Ardeen Watts. Ardeen is a gifted pianist, used to be associate conductor of the symphony, and when the rains arrive in the spring, he goes wandering in the fields west of the city. Because mushrooms are a perfect symbol for Ardeen's philosophy of life, a love of unruly things. Go see the short film at videowest.kuer.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Tim Sullivan planned a road trip around the West without a car, he wasn't just trying to challenge himself or be novel. He was trying to figure out if the West was changing like the rest of the country seems to be in its reliance on the automobile. Sullivan says there's evidence to believe we've seen the peak of cars in this country, that for the first time since the car was invented, auto travel is slowing down. But is that happening here in the West, where we've always used cars much more than the rest of the country? And of course, there are practical reasons for this, the vast open space of the region, for example. But there are more abstract reasons, too. The West is about individuality, and it's about freedom, and public transportation is often a tough sell around here. So Sullivan headed out to find out what the West would feel like without the speed or convenience of a car, and if it was even possible. He's joining us today to talk about what he learned. We're hoping you'll join us with your own thoughts about all of this. Can you do it? Can you get around the West without a car? What would it take to get you out of your car? What's keeping you from ditching your car for other modes of transportation? Have you already given up a car? If so, has it changed your life for better, for worse? 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Tim Sullivan is an urban planner with the Utah-based transportation consulting firm Interplan, and he's the author of No Communication with the Sea. His new book is Ways to the West, How Getting Out of Our Cars is Reclaiming America's Frontier. He's giving a reading tonight at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program. Tim Sullivan, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I'm trying to get a sense of when this idea came to you of doing this road trip. And you begin the book very early on by saying, I loved road trips when I was a kid. But like the rest of us, you just kind of liked going out on these road trips, what, with your family, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's where it started. We it seemed like we left just about every weekend, especially, you know, in the spring we'd head down to Canyonlands and to Arches and Capitol Reef. In the summer we'd head up to Idaho and the Wind Rivers in Wyoming. And in the fall go down to the desert again. And even in the winter, maybe we'd go skiing somewhere. So we were always on the road. And I really gained an appreciation from that, from my family. You know, and then when I became older as a teenager, I did the same thing with my friends and just kind of went down to the desert and up to the mountains and just hit the road every weekend.
But what was it about a road trip? I mean, I get it. There's the destination part. Oh, we got to take a long trip to get to Canyonlands. But there's more to it than that, right? I mean, that's part of the journey. That's part of it.
It was the journey. And as I say in the book, you know, one of the things that I realized later about why I love the road trip so much is that I feel like traveling in the West really embodies a lot of, you know, what people love about the United States. It's kind of the most extreme version of it. You know,
which means what? That it's beautiful and weird and
the landscape, the sense of opportunity and freedom and openness. You know, you look at literature and culture and just and the energy of moving West. You know, you kind of see that thread throughout the history of the U.S. And you know, I think as you know, being on the road, I felt like a part of that story.
Yeah. So this is what you mean when you said that you on your road trips that you sensed something that about the West that you were really only able to pinpoint later, and that was that this wasn't just the scenery. I mean, it's lovely, but there was something else, and this is a big theme in your book. This idea that it's freedom, opportunity, those kinds of things. When did you identify that, and how could you sense freedom and opportunity from, you know, miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of sagebrush? Do you know what I mean?
Well, a lot of this was actually after moving to the Bay Area. I lived in Oakland for 10 years and living a different kind of life where I was on the road less. Yeah. We bought a house. We had a family, got married and had a family. And that's sort of how this road trip came about, is that I just kind of wanted a road trip. I wanted to take 3 weeks and just get on the road without any particular destination. And at the same time, you know, this book was a confluence of a lot of different things. And one of the other things that fed into it was, you know, being a planner, you know, realizing the history of communities and how communities work, that, you know, I started to realize the big picture about the West.
You say the car has, here's how you put it in the book, jeopardized the West's mythic hold on the American future. Explain what that means.
Well, I think the West has always been about the future. I think the West has always been open to new ideas and has innovated a lot of things, maybe foremost about the types of communities we've lived in. Mm-hmm. And there's always been the sense, especially when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, the West was always growing. The growth just seemed invincible.
Yeah.
And that it would always keep going, and that it was largely fueled by automobile-oriented communities and growth. Whole economies were based on growth and construction. Yeah. And so, you know, as I say in there, it's the cities of the West are more like, you know, upward arrows, and, you know, that they're not necessarily these well thought out places to live. They were just these growth machines. And so you always sort of thought about the future in terms of more and more growth. But then the Great Recession happened, and you started to see mass foreclosures in places like Las Vegas that were the most auto-dependent places and were the most, you know, had grown the quickest.
Yeah.
And that had really had been built as with the least amount of thought given to them. And so, there was a lot of money and not a lot of time. And so the common denominator was really the automobile for that.
You say that cars have betrayed the American West in some ways. So explain what you mean, because you see sort of a contradiction here that we always figured that the car was part of that idea of freedom, but that's not what you're saying. That's not really what it's
well,
about.
Well, it was.
It was.
It was.
Yeah.
It, basically what I say is that the car really promised all these things about America, and that, you know, I think the other piece to this book is, you know, I wanted to take the road trip, and then I was sort of at the same time in professionally, you know, realizing how important transportation was to communities, and that the shape of communities just always went back to parking, how you got around, you know, all these things just depended on how you get around, basically. As I looked into it more, I saw this bigger picture of transportation in the West, that transportation had essentially created these things that we love about it. Opportunity. It defined how we see the landscape, how we perceive the landscape. It gave it that sense of the future, mobility, all these things that are important. So transportation created these things in the beginning, and what the automobile did was it heightened them.
Yeah.
It gave us it basically made us go faster, gave us more freedom, gave us more opportunity. You know, thinking about the times after World War II when the West started to see its one of its biggest growth periods. But those returns began to diminish. Those were not sustainable things, and so that's what I mean by it betrayed us. It really we gave ourselves to the automobile, and we planned our communities almost solely around it. And now we're beginning to see, I guess, the fallacy of depending so heavily on the automobile in planning our communities.
But is it too late? I mean, once you put concrete down and asphalt down, and once you have blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of suburbs, of houses, you've got to get in a car to get to the grocery store. So, and we'll work into the details as we go along, but too late. We already made this plan, and it happened in Las Vegas, and it happened in Centerville, and it happened, you know, just name the cities. Mm-hmm. Is it too late? Is the question.
Well, as you know, I have the quote in there of Chris Leinberger, who's an urbanist and a developer, that once large lot suburban communities are built, they are very hard to unbuild, and that's true. But I think different planners and folks in the industry would disagree a lot on this question. I think that's one of the key questions: is it too late?
Yeah.
I'm an optimist, so I say no. And I think that's a lot of where our profession is these days, is retrofitting a lot of these communities, because we're looking less to greenfields, which is, you know, unbuilt areas of metro areas, and we're looking more toward infill, brownfields, cleaning up old, you know, industrial sites, or retrofitting suburban communities. And honestly, in my work, that tends to be a lot of what I do is helping communities give themselves more options for transportation within and not only transportation, but the types of housing that influences, types of mixes of land use, the things that support more people-oriented communities. So I would say it's not too late, but we have to be very strategic about how we go about this.
You say that the words that have come to define the West, freedom, opportunity, mobility, those three in particular – They need to evolve.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Yeah. Well, I think that especially when we think about mobility, that there's been a very narrow definition of mobility,
yeah.
And it's highway lanes, and so mobility is very important. It's you know, we need to get around. I think I would argue that we need to think less about, you know, pure mobility in terms of moving about one of our metro areas. But it still is very important. But I think we can expand the definition of it.
Yeah. How do you expand the definition of mobility?
Well, I think in terms of how it's actually implemented in plans. I mean, I think we need to, you know, I don't know if people have heard about complete streets. Thinking about incorporating more transportation modes. Mobility is bicycling around a community. Mobility is taking transit around a community, and mobility is very much walking around a community.
Is it in some ways the way we've misdefined the idea of convenience? Is that part of it? Mobility for me, how long does it take me to get to the coffee shop?
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying is, look, you can get there, but you've got to be creative about it, because mm-hmm. it doesn't just mean finding a spot in the parking lot. Take a bike.
Right. And you may actually get there faster on a bike if you have to find a parking spot and pay for a parking spot.
Yeah.
So a lot of the way I think about transportation is sort of comes down to economics. It's the economics of a household. And more that economically it makes more sense not to drive because, you know, people are having to live further and further out. They're basically trading, you know, transportation for housing costs and and, you know, you factor in parking, you factor in sometimes time, car ownership, that it is cheaper just to make it more simple and walk.
I mentioned this in the introduction, and I wanted to have you talk a little bit more about it. That there's a reason to believe we've seen the peak of cars. Americans, you say in the book, are now commuting less by private vehicles, and this has never happened since the dawn of the auto age, more than a century before. That's a big deal.
It is. The key metric that people have looked at for that is called vehicle miles traveled, which is, you know, how many miles cars are traveling, you know, in the U.S. And around 2004, before the recession, you started to see the vehicle miles traveled had increased since the dawn of the auto age. Every year, and sometimes some cases very steeply, but it plateaued in 2004, 2005, and declined for every year for the next 10 years. And we've seen a small uptick in the last year or so, year and a half or so, No one knows exactly what that means. Reed might be able to talk a little bit more about that, what he thinks.
We have another two people joining us just here in a moment. But yeah, keep going. Sorry.
So we don't know exactly what's happening, but it's not, you know, nearly up to current, you know, what trends would have been. So that's the main thing people are looking at when they're seeing, maybe we've seen the peak of the automobile, is that people are simply driving less in cars.
And in the West, is it different?
Yes,
is it an anomaly?
No, this is a trend that's everywhere in the United States.
Here is an email from Marcus, who writes, "My car broke down in 2010. Didn't want to burden my friends and coworkers, so I reluctantly picked up a UTA bus schedule. Cut to 5 years later, I'm still taking public transit. I love it. My commute via bus and tracks is 50 minutes to and from work. I use the time to decompress, to listen to music, and my podcasts has become my time," he writes. "I think more people would enjoy a train if they gave it a shot." Is that a theme that you hear from time to time? Like, that sounds terrible. And then they do it and they're like, that was not so bad. I didn't have to worry about this and that. And do you hear that a lot?
I do hear it, and I live it too, because I love transit. I love the time that I get on the train. I take the train, I would say, most days to work. And I love public spaces, you know, as being an urban planner. I love public spaces that are populated by all different kinds of people. And the way I think about a train is a moving public space, is that you have, you know, people are coming in and out all the time. And I think, you know, that here along the Wasatch Front, I ride the Red Line out to Midvale, you know, and I see a lot. It really feels like a working part of the Wasatch Front now. It doesn't feel like a novelty. People are coming in and out. You see a crazy diversity of people along there. It's just very interesting, and it's well ridden. So it's a pleasurable experience in that way, but also it gives you some downtime. But I think the caveat to that is that there are transit experiences that are not as pleasant, and that a lot of what we need to do is to improve the quality, you know, of service, to make it more convenient and comfortable for people to ride transit.
Okay, let's get a few more voices involved in the conversation. When we get back from a break, we're going to do that. But let's just establish the idea, your road trip. You picked six cities. How did you select the ones you did?
I was just looking into what was going on in them in terms of – I wanted this book to be have positive stories of change. You know, I didn't want this to be – talking about the negative aspects of what was going on had been done. And I wanted to establish that, but I wanted to see positive stories that was happening. And really, as I looked more into the issues, you know, I saw these themes emerge of how are we reclaiming these things that we love about the West. And so, you know, I looked to see how different cities were embodying these different themes. So then it came down to logistics. I did this trip, you know, on a shoestring in 3 weeks. Yeah. So they had to connect. I got one shot to do all this. So it's sort of like shooting a movie in one take.
Right.
So I had to connect them in some way. And so that's really how the trip, it was both very kind of thematic, but also very practical.
You picked Las Vegas. You picked Salt Lake, of course. You picked Denver, Phoenix, Boise, and Portland. Portland is really instructive in a number of ways because it seems like they, like a generation before, made a very crucial decision that we're starting to see learn some lessons from. You want to talk a little bit about Portland in that way? Because I think that just before we move on to some of the other ones, Portland seems like they made this decision. They were thinking about this before the rest of us were in some ways in the West.
Yeah, I kind of think of Portland as kind of a coda for this book. It's just different than the rest of the cities, and in some ways,
and we're talking about Portland, Oregon.
Right.
I did not
take the train out to Portland. Maybe.
Right.
But I think it's an unfair comparison in some ways. I think it's a West Coast city that is different than you know, interior West cities. But at the same time, the thing that makes it a great comparable to cities like Salt Lake. Are that it didn't inherit any sort of great old subway system or urban density or it wasn't a really large city. Portland's slightly larger than Salt Lake City in terms of the metro area. And what's been successful about them and how they've provided transportation options and great sense of urbanism there is through public policy, is through, as you said, making great decisions starting, I don't know, 40 years ago, even maybe before that. And there are some other kind of lucky things about Portland. It has a very small box, and the economy's always kind of been down there, so they never bulldozed a lot of their old streetcar commercial districts. I lived in Portland for 2 years and got to really experience it and love it. But I think it was a good comparison in the way that as a coda to this, and that we can show us, okay, here's somebody that thought about this a city that thought about this early on, and how, you know, maybe we can get there someday.
Tim Sullivan is with us. His book is called Ways to the West, and he's going to be reading the book at the King's English Bookshop. Well, from the book. He won't read the whole book. Sorry, I didn't put that very well. He's going to be reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City tonight at 7 o'clock. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. You can join us, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we are asking, what would it take for you to ditch your car? Maybe not get rid of it entirely, but how about stop using it so much? What would it take? Tim Sullivan is among our guests today. He's written a book where he explains what it was like to go on a road trip throughout the Intermountain West and then up in Portland without a car. He says the West was built around the idea of freedom, and a car was part of that for a while, but that's changing. He has a book, which is called Ways to the West. He's going to be reading from the book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. We'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program. Also joining us now is Andrea Olson, president of the transportation consulting firm Interplan. And Andrea, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. We also have with us at least Will here in a moment. We had some problems with the connection there. Reed Ewing, he's a professor of city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah. He directs the Metropolitan Research Center here at the U, but he's not here at the U. He's in Italy on sabbatical, a visiting professor there, so we're having some problems getting him, so we should get him here in a moment. But Andrea Olson, I wanted to jump into a couple of things. This is something you've been looking at, and I think Reed Ewing can join us when he does and give us some particulars, but that is, I think a lot of people put a lot of hope in the millennial generation.
Right.
That if, for some reason, as Tim was talking about earlier, there's this peak and we're maybe headed in another direction, that we can put some of our hope on younger people and the way they're thinking about getting around mm-hmm. a city or getting around in general. Is that true, first of all? Is a new generation, the millennials in particular, younger people in general, are they rethinking the relationship with cars?
I think that that is true. I think in Utah, we see that a little bit differently than the trends that we're seeing nationally. You know, there have been several surveys done at a national level, and the Utah Foundation actually did some research recently comparing Utah millennials to their counterparts on the national level. And we tend to trend the same way. People are of that generation are driving less, taking transit more, walking more, bicycling more. And in Utah, they're doing that, but the change isn't necessarily to the same degree that we've seen at the national level. But they're trending in the right direction.
Because why? Is that typical in red states? Do you know why we're just more conservative?
A little bit more conservative, but I think, you know, if you look at the demographics of that group, they're more likely to be married than their national counterparts. They're more likely to own a home. They're more likely to have children. They're more likely to own a car. So I think all of those things combined.
Mormon culture in particular.
I think that certainly contributes to it. So I think all of those factors together combine to, you know, just make us a little bit slower to pick up on this national trend.
So Mormon kids are more likely to get married younger. More
right.
likely to want to get out into the suburbs sooner?
Yes. One of the questions that was asked both nationally and by the Utah Foundation locally is, what's your ideal urban, what's your ideal setting in terms of, you know, where you want to live? And millennials in Utah tend to answer a medium-sized city or the suburbs. They're more likely to give that as their ideal place to live rather than what you're seeing at the national level is the big city. You know, this age group likes to live in big cities, and it's somewhat less so here.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. George is with us, calling from Layton, Utah. George, hi.
Hi, darling. It's nice to be on your program again. And I didn't choose to be without a car, but my wife passed away, and then I couldn't afford the payments, and it got repossessed. So I'm living here in Davis County and relying on the bus and walking. And it's been almost 3 years now, going on 3 years, I should say. And I'm getting very used to it. And, you know, as Tim was saying about the train, you get on the train and, you know, Wi-Fi is on there and you can sit there and read if you want to, or you can do something on your phone. And a lot of people do. And people bring their bicycles and they get on the train. Basically, decided, you know, to learn to plan what I'm doing more, and instead of trying to do three or four things in a day or more than that, one for sure, maybe two. And that's the same way I would do it if I was traveling to a different city like Paris or Bombay or Washington. You have to rely on their capability.
So, Andrea and Tim, we'll talk about that, will you? Because this is seems to be one of those themes that you hear from time to time that, and Tim, you were sort of talking about this earlier, you got to rethink what you think about mobility. And it just takes a reordering of the way you think about your day and just maybe it's a kind of a cultural thing too. You've got to rethink some of the basics of your life in some ways. Is that right? Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller brings up a few different points. I mean, on one hand, it was, you know, what I was talking about before, that it can be, you know, a way to slow down, to just have more quality time. But on the other hand, he was saying that he really didn't have a choice. And so I think healthier transit markets in the U.S. are ones that have more what we call choice riders, or that people that are riding for, because they want to ditch their cars. But there are a lot of people, in every metro area that have to ride transit, that don't own cars because of economic reasons or other reasons. And I think it's important for us as transportation planners and everyone else affecting it to make that a good experience for people. To really think also about what we call transit dependent riders.
So we've been sort of talking, we named this program, what's the tipping point? It seems like the tipping – so for George, the tipping point was some personal circumstances that made him – so he had to start taking transportation. But I'm wondering, what is the tipping point – at what point do you start to lay this all out on a sheet and say it's inconvenient to take a car now? The traffic is driving me nuts. It's on, you know, I'm seeing this haze in January. That's driving me crazy. What's the sort of practical tipping point for people? They're starting to think, it makes more sense for me to take public transportation. Do we understand what that point is?
Well, I guess I think that it is ultimately going to come down to cost and convenience. I've been doing a little bit of research.
Self-interest.
Right. I've been doing a little research lately, and specifically on this millennials demographic that we were talking about. And I talked to some leasing agents in buildings along the 400 South Corridor in Salt Lake City, which, you know, has a Trax line and is very popular right now. There's several, multi-unit residential buildings going up. And actually Reed, if he is able to join us, has done a lot of research on that specific corridor. But in talking to people there, their tenants want to live there because of the transit access. They're either going downtown or they're going to the University of Utah, so they want to be able to ride the train, but they still want their car.
Yeah.
You know, one of the women I talked to talked about an apartment of four women that have four cars between them, and they ride the train regularly, but they want their car, they want to have access to it. So I think when it's more convenient to get on the train, which I think in some corridors where that's where we're getting. But I also think, you know, when it costs money to park your car every month, like it does in, you know, San Francisco, New York and things like that. And I don't think our land values are at the point yet where, you know, parking your car, if you're not going to drive it, is a huge expense to you. And yeah. I think once we're move more in that direction or get there, I think we're going to see a bigger change.
So I guess that was my question. It seems like you can't really get away from those basic market principles that people are going to behave based on self-interest. Convenience is going to be one thing. So they're not – I mean, you may have that faction, and I would guess it would be somewhat smaller population-wise, who say, I'm ditching my car for the good of my carbon footprint and all of those kinds of things. You can't build a transportation system around whether people want to do the right thing. You have to build it based on whether it's going to be convenient and work for them in their lives. Is that
yeah?
Is
it's
that
first and foremost economics. And the place that I really mind this question is in Denver, along what's called the Southeast Corridor, which is this segment of I-25 south of Denver that is a huge employment corridor and was really created by the automobile in the sense of wanting to get away from downtown Denver and all the congestion, but then it became congested itself. And so they've put light rail along that corridor, and you know, there's a ton of huge – there's Fortune 500 employers along there, companies along there. And so I brought that question to those people, and I have a chapter called The Equation. That's what I call it. It's an equation where basically that kind of equals, you know, with transit, car – you know, bike. There are just different things that feed into it. It's cost, it's time, it's convenience, it's the experience, and there you just have to manipulate that equation for people. And so I heard all different kinds of answers, and a lot of it came down to the employer, the role of the employer. In a lot of the times, they would give discounted transit passes, or you'd have a congestion management agency that was able to subsidize transit passes. And so then you bring down the cost of transit for those people. And so the equation changes. But yeah, I think it's definitely an economic question.
And it's just a matter of fine-tuning it.
It's what we call transportation travel demand management, is taking that demand side of the equation and fine-tuning that and changing the demand.
I think we have Reed Ewing with us, though. Something happened to his internet connection, so we have him by cell phone. We have him by cell phone from Italy, so I feel dicey about that. But Reed Ewing, I'm going to introduce you again, and we'll see how it goes. Again, a professor of city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah. He directs the Metropolitan Research Center. He's also an editor of the Journal of the American Planning Association. And Professor Ewing, welcome to you.
Well, thank you so much. Sorry about the connection.
No, that's okay. This doesn't sound too bad. There's a little delay here. We'll sound like the BBC for a minute. That's okay. So Reed Ewing, how do you describe – let me get your general impression of the conversation that you've been able to hear anyway so far. Let me ask a particular question. How do you describe residents of Utah generally and their relationship with their cars? Are we different? We talked a little bit with Andrea about millennials and the difference. Are we different than the rest of the country in significant ways? I mean, we tend to be conservative. How do you describe Utahns and their relationship with their car in general?
More conservative than the U.S. Also, in terms of their residential choices, they're more likely to opt for the single-family home on the large lot than people in other parts of the country. Right now in the United States, about half of the people who are surveyed say that they would like to live in a more village-like setting where things are within walking distance of home, and they're willing to opt for a smaller lot or even a multifamily housing to get the convenience of a more urban place. And about half of Americans want the large lot in the suburbs. And here it looks like a larger percentage want the large lot in the suburbs. Now, that may be changing. But we did what's called a stated preference survey, which asked people what they want in their residential neighborhoods. And really, really high percentage of people said the most important thing is having parking, free parking on site, so they don't have to walk or pay for parking. That was number one. And you know, right up there was having a single-family home in a single-family neighborhood. So I think we are more conservative. The millennials in that survey looked more conservative. The only cohort that looked a little different was the baby boom generation. They seemed more inclined to live in a kind of mixed housing, mixed use area. For the most part, we are more conservative, and it shows in our mode choices. 88% of all the trips in this region are automobile trips. About 7 to 8% are walk trips. Something like 2%, a little around 2% are transit trips, and about a little less than that are bike trips. So we're that's compared to the U.S. as a whole, where 11% of the trips are walk trips, and bike trips are about the same as here, and transit trips are higher. So we are more conservative, and that's something we have to deal with. And what one thing that hasn't come up yet is land use patterns, except it did, Doug, in your question about the suburbs. Once they're built, aren't you stuck with them?
Yeah.
And to some degree, you are. The average single-family house is going to be around for 100 years or more. So it's only really in arterial corridors where you have right now commercial or industrial uses that you'd expect to find a lot of redevelopment. And fortunately, there are those. The other thing that hasn't come up much is transit-oriented development. If we want people to use transit, we've got to provide them with livable places right next to transit. And these are denser, and they typically have a mix of uses, residential and retail, and they're very pedestrian-oriented, and we've been looking at them in other regions of the country. We just completed a study of Redmond TOD in Seattle, and the people who live in that transit-oriented development in Redmond drive about a third as much as the typical suburban household. So you have to make land use patterns front and center. If we want people to walk or use transit, we're going to have to provide them with walkable and transit-oriented places.
So Tim Sullivan's an optimist. Are you a pessimist? I mean, I think the question is, you know, when you talk about, and when you look at the figures, when you look at the dynamics, the cultural dynamics, the fact that you've pointed out, Reed Ewing, that only 3% of trips are by transit right now. I mean, you seem kind of skeptical about whether we're even approaching a tipping point where more people are going to choose public transportation or other options. Tim's an optimist. Are you a pessimist?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a pessimist. I'm probably about as adamant about, you know, a lot of my writing has been on urban sprawl and all of the costs of sprawl and auto dependence and all of the costs associated with that, from air pollution to obesity and on. So, you know, I'm terribly concerned about automobile dependence and what Tim referred to before, the VMT, vehicle miles traveled, which is an indicator of just how auto-dependent we are. But I guess I'm also a little bit, maybe not as optimistic as Tim is, that we can change those habits. One thing that Tim mentioned that is important is the fact that vehicle miles traveled has gone down since 2004. So something's going on.
Yeah.
We also know that people want to live, an increasing number of people want to live in these more urban communities, and particularly the millennials. They're particularly attracted to urban neighborhoods. So something is going on, but I guess I wouldn't write off the automobile just yet, not when it has such a dominant market share.
Yeah.
I think we need to think maybe in terms of baby steps on this, because it's not the question of, okay, we're, you know, at a 80, 88%, you know, mode share on automobiles to basically everybody ditching their cars. It's kind of thinking more about, you know, in my work, and I, you know, work with a lot of communities throughout this region, everybody seems to want more diversity in the types of places. And, you know, I was going to mention this on, you know, how does the tipping point happen? I think as much as looking at those little details that we were talking about in terms of transportation demand, you have to look at the big picture of the types of communities that we're building. And it's land use, it's mixes of land use, it's the design of the places and how the buildings are integrated with the sidewalks and how much space is given to people rather than cars. It's just a holistic solution in terms of the types of communities. And so you need to, you know, create, as Reed said, create those communities that are supportive of other transportation modes. But I really do hear from people that they want something different, that they want maybe that they're not going to ditch their car, maybe, but maybe they will instead of, you know,
use it differently,
use it less, that you've got to start making places that are more humane as a starting point.
But if we're talking about let me take a couple of points. Reed Ewing talked about the importance of land use and the idea of development and planning communities based on these ideas. Well, you need to get buy-in by developers, first of all, which means you also need to get buy-in by political leaders, policymakers. Is that an obstacle?
Less and less, I would say.
I think that's right. I was part of a conference that just happened on Tuesday of this week, and the mayor of Harriman was in the group that I was with, and he pointed out that, and, you know, I think if people think of Harriman, they think of, you know, large lot, single family homes. But he pointed out the fact that, you know, what he's really hearing is that people want a mix of housing styles in Harriman. They want to be able, the city wants to be able to accommodate, you know, everybody from the young professional that wants, you know, a condo or an apartment or something like that, all the way to the family with a few children. And they want to be able to live in Harriman and work and recreate and that kind of stuff. So I do think that there is some movement, you know, from the politicians in recognizing that that's what people are starting to envision themselves.
What are you saying, Reed Ewing? Do we have the policy support, political will in this state to pull this off?
I think it's coming around. You know, one thing I've noticed is it seems that every suburban community wants a town center now, a walkable town center. So you know, Sandy and South Jordan and these communities that you think of in terms of urban or suburban sprawl do want to offer more choices. The question is, you know, relative degrees, and what will happen when there's neighborhood opposition from surrounding neighborhoods to these denser, more urban projects. You know, just the reaction to the rezoning along the S line, the Sugar House streetcar line, the opposition from the neighbors, and the fact that that rezoning hadn't gone through, suggests that politicians are reluctant to, you know, take on NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, yeah. And
that's Sugar House. You know, that's a more politically progressive sort of sensibility.
Yeah. I love the optimism. I really do, and I've got some of it. And I can point to studies and surveys and our own work on transit-oriented development in Seattle and Denver and so on. But I think we need to be somewhat circumspect as we take on these new challenges and realize that it's going to be very, very hard to overcome our auto dependence.
Reed Ewing, he is teaches city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah, directs the university's Metropolitan Research Center. He's on sabbatical in Italy, where he's got a decent cell connection with us, which is good. We have Andrea Olson, president of the transportation consulting firm Interplan, and Tim Sullivan, whose new book is called Ways to the West. He's going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City tonight at 7 o'clock. Details for that on our website, radiowest.org. So we had a caller, Linda, who was... is she back with us? Good. Well, we're going to get you when we get back to from a break, Linda. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address. Again, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about transportation and about the novel idea that Tim Sullivan came up with in his book to take a road trip in the West without a car. And it's raised a lot of big questions about the way we plan communities, about our dependence on cars, how things may or may not be changing. His book is called Ways to the West. He's giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop tonight. We'll give you details about that a little bit later. He's with us along with Andrea Olson, president of the transportation consulting firm Interplan, and Professor Reed Ewing, who teaches city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah, is joining us by cell phone from Italy. Let's take a call from Linda, who is with us in Salt Lake. Linda, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi. The reason I called is that I've lived where there was good transit and where there wasn't great transit. And what we need in this area to get more people riding instead of driving is more transit, which UTA has promised they'd do if they get this little sales tax raise in the fall. And it costs money, but they promise more frequent buses every 15 minutes earlier and later in the day, and on weekend service so that you don't have to have a car to go to grandma for Thanksgiving, and better human services and better bus stops. And
yeah,
I think that's what we need. So just remember that nothing's free.
Right. Well,
it costs $7,000 or $8,000 a year just to own a car.
Yeah. Well, Linda has she's sort of introduced what has become a big theme. And we're hearing from Connor, a caller from Salt Lake City, comes from Chicago. His fiancée comes from London. They know public transit well. They're frustrated, though, because it's difficult. I mean, Paulette says it just costs too much public transportation. She says, I'd prefer to take a train downtown than look for parking, but when I figure it would cost $10 for my husband and me round trip, it's just not – she can't justify it. Daniel also sends this email saying, you know, I think our family is in the same situation as many others in Utah County. We'd love to do our part, but it's just too expensive to take public transit. Nancy writes, I would use it if it stopped closer to my destinations. I hate driving. Utah's become crazy crowded, but public transportation doesn't quite work for her. And I could go on and on and on. Respond to that. Tim Sullivan, let's start with you. Because as you said off the air a moment ago, you hear this complaint, maybe principally among people?
I mean, transit is expensive. I think that the way we look at it sometimes is by looking at it in terms of different trips and trying to make different trips cheaper by transit. And I think the easiest way to tackle that is by where a lot of people are concentrated, and that's, you know, basically the commute, and looking at how employers can make transit cheaper by again, it comes down to economics by, you know, giving that critical mass of demand, and so then it's becoming more of a better market for the provider, and it's becoming cheaper. And so the places that tends to be working are corridors with a lot of jobs that are accessible by by high capacity transit. So it starts there, and then you kind of work off that. But we're still at the very beginning, and trying to create. Have it make sense for not necessarily an entire transit lifestyle, but just to start with just the commute trip and maybe.
What do you think? This public transportation problems. I mean, it's not convenient. It's too expensive. All of those kinds of things. How do you respond to that?
I think, cost is obviously part of the equation. But I think, as Tim mentioned, convenience is a huge thing, too. And if you
that,
have,
that almost matters more for people.
If you have to constantly be checking schedules. And granted, there are a lot of, apps available to see when the next bus is coming and things like that. But what transit agencies typically, you know, want to get to is 10 or 15 minute, and we call them headways, just the time between one bus to the next bus. And and when you're on that kind of a schedule, you know, you can throw away the schedule. You show up at a bus stop or a train stop, and you know one is going to be there in a fairly short amount of time. And so I think getting a system to that point, you know, would make an incredible difference for people in their.
But how realistic is that in Utah? And how far off are we from that? Costs a lot. Mm-hmm. So is it even realistic to want that?
Well, I think it's certainly realistic to want it. It's not going to happen tomorrow or next week or. You know, I think UTA is certainly getting closer to that. They're moving some of their major bus lines on their major corridors towards 15-minute headways. But, you know, they run a lot of buses, and to get them all to that point is that's a lot of resources.
And I think you have to look at it in terms of, you know, districts and corridors, and not so much the whole city or the metro region, but let's focus on getting one corridor with the supporting land use so that people are able to make a lot of trips on foot, that are able to not have cars, so you're able to lower your parking amounts, and so you're able to fill that with more density of human beings. And because of that, there's more demand on the side of transit. You're able to create better headways, more frequent trains. It all just feeds off of each other. And it's hard to do that and think about that for the whole metro area. But you think about that, say, just one corridor, like say the 4 South corridor or the industrial corridors like Reed was talking about along I-15
and tracks. That gets you started.
Yeah. And what that does, and what I think I was driving at a little bit in the Phoenix part, is one of the things that I think that the transit system there has done, which Phoenix is even more car happy than we are here, is that it's given its young people there who want a different lifestyle. It's given them that
choice.
Has
Trax done that for here?
I think it has. Yeah. I think it's started to say, you know, you can live a different lifestyle if you want to. You're not in the middle of
so
Paris
it's a matter of
anything.
Just seeing the possibilities. That you're starting to see, hey.
Yeah.
That's cool. That
yeah. And work. I think, I mean, I basically ended with you know, thinking about two rules. And one is that you've got to give people choices. You've got to give people transportation options. I mean, that's just fundamentally what we need to do. The second one is, you know, every city needs to be a city for walking. And walking is really the fundamental piece of this.
Man, we have so much more to talk about. We are out of time. We'll have you back, and we'll get Reed Ewing when he's back here to actually join us as well. Reed Ewing teaches city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah, joined us sort of from Italy. We had Andrea Olson with us, president of Interplan. Thank you very much
Doug,
with us. Tim Sullivan, Ways to the West is the name of his book. He's reading from it tonight at the King's English Bookshop at 7 o'clock. Details on our website. Tim Sullivan, thanks to you.
Thanks a lot for having me, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KEWR News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.